First, we're studying Providence and Theodicy in medieval Jewish thought. Today's our last class on Maimonides, the Guide to the Perplexed. We had, a wonderful class last week in talking about Maimonides' commentary on the book of Job. And right now, we're going to read a little bit from the sheets I gave out, the summary sheet, to very, very shortly summarize things we talked in the past. And today in our last class, we're going to study the end of the Guide to the Perplexed, chapter 51. So at the top of the sheet, I wrote all the material we've studied so far in the guide. We don't have to go over that. And then as far as conclusions, very briefly I wrote the following. Overarching principles, there are three. There is indeed individual divine providence. Men get what they deserve, and there is no suffering without sin. The Rambam quoted the Gemara about that, and he emphasized again and again and again that point. And it's individual, not just collective. Providence, second point, is conditional upon one's reception of the constant and unchanging flow of divine knowledge toward us. God is static and unchanging, and providence has nothing to do with personalized divine reaction to man, but rather is totally about man's tapping into the constant divine knowledge. And of course, that's only telegraphing of things we learn for many weeks, we understand it. More knowledge, the third point, means more providence. The sin which brings suffering is ignorance and behavior based on ignorance. Okay? All that's review of the most salient points. We saw next three types of evil in the world, that which is necessitated by the nature of matter, two, that which is inflicted upon others, three, that which is inflicted upon oneself. And then, based on that, there were three levels of providence. The first level was in chapters 10 and 12 and 16, 18 and 20 of the guide, tapping into the divine overflow of practical intellect in order to successfully navigate the world, in order to prevent self-inflicted evil, which is by far the most prevalent evil in the world. That's providence in a nutshell, that I know by opening up my receivers to the divine knowledge that's available and flowing into the world, and I know how to live responsibly and healthily and properly in order that most of the self-inflicted evils that people inflict upon themselves, that are 95% of the reasons that people suffer, I don't suffer from them. Because I know how to use the divine knowledge properly. And that is called reward and punishment. I'm rewarded for being responsible based on my responsible gaining of knowledge. Aaron called it independent of God. But if you look at it from a Maimonidean perspective, it's totally dependent on God, because all the knowledge is flowing from God, and I made a decision and I made the effort to tap into that knowledge, and in doing so I'm considered to be connected to God. It's my connection to God that saves me from disease. But of course you have to know what the meaning of those words are. What does it mean? Connection to God that saves you from disease. It's through the knowledge, the tapping into the knowledge of medicine, of economics, of physics, that saves me from mishaps, and that is called divine providence. That's level number one. Level number two of providence, it comes from Maimonides' interpretation of the book of Job, which we did last week. Purification of one's attitude towards the physical world in order to make oneself stoically immune to the supposed suffering that the physical world can bring upon oneself. This refers to categories 2 and 3 of evil, inflicted by others, inflicted... No, categories 1 and 2. I'm sorry, categories 1 and 2. In other words, good morning, in other words, I may suffer disease that has nothing to do with my actions. It's not inflicted by myself. And therefore, knowledge of medicine would not help me to overcome it. And there might be evil inflicted by others, like the bandits that came and killed all of Job's family. But I can overcome that by a deep tapping into the divine knowledge that teaches me what's really important and really central in this world. Teaches me that what's really important is the mind and the spirit, and what happens to my body. What happens to other people's bodies is totally irrelevant. And therefore, Job was able to, through knowledge, at the end of the book, overcome all his suffering, not that it suddenly went away. But what the book says, that Job was granted again more wealth and more prosperity than at the outset, it's an allegory. It doesn't mean that he really got it. It means he understood that he already had that prosperity to begin with because he had his mind. And everything that happened to his children, his family, and his wealth was totally irrelevant, and it no longer bothered him. He overcame it through his understanding, and that's providence. That's called providence. When I use God's knowledge to overcome stoically, emotionally, to overcome my attachment to the body and to wealth and to affluence and to corporality, that is called providence. That's God's knowledge helping me to live a life in which I feel that I've been rewarded. The knowledge rewards me. That's the second type of providence.
I'm thinking about Buddhism and the Buddhists and that attachment.
It's related. Of course it's related.
Yeah.
And the third type of divine providence we're learning today in our last class on chapter 51 of the guide. You ready? And when we finish, we'll read the last paragraphs of the sheet I prepared, which sums up chapter 51. Let me preface page 620 of the new handout from today.
Oh, okay.
Page 620, everyone received it, I think. Let me preface our study today with the following. Shmuel ibn Tibon was a younger contemporary of the Rambam, and he took it upon himself to translate the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed from Arabic into Hebrew. He prepared a first draft of the translation, and when he finished, he wrote a letter to the Rambam asking a certain number of questions as to the proper translation, the proper understanding of a number of different passages. One of the major issues that bothered Shmuel ibn Tibon was the matter of providence that we've been studying. And he summarized his understanding of providence according to the Rambam and included it in this letter. And the things we've talked about are according to what he wrote there. And at the end of the letter, the part of it talking about providence, he related to chapter 51 of the guide at the very, very end. And he said to the Rambam, "Here I'm mystified. I have no idea what you're talking about." And he laid out the issues and he laid out the possible solutions. And this letter was sent to the Rambam, and the Rambam died before answering it.
He wouldn't have time to answer him anyway. He's so busy being a doctor.
So chapter 51 is quite an enigma. Shmuel ibn Tibon does not have a hard and fast theory of how to understand it. His son, Moshe ibn Tibon, does have a theory. He adopted something of what his father had suggested as his certainty as to what it means. We're going to talk about the way Moshe ibn Tibon understood chapter 51. At the end, we're going to talk about the way one modern researcher, Charles Rappel from Yeshiva University, an article he wrote about 30 years ago, how he understands chapter 51. Here we go. Chapter 51, it's page 620 and the third part of the guide, the top of the page. There are those who set their thought to work after having attained perfection of divine science, turn wholly toward God, may he be cherished and held sublime, renounce what is other than he, renounce the corporeal world, and direct all the acts of their intellect towards an examination of the beings with a view to drawing from them truth with regard to him, so as to know him, to know his governance, means providence, of them in whatever way it is possible. So this is the Rambam at the end of the guide, talking about the highest level of spirituality. 99% of human beings, of course, don't get there. It's about that small group of men of the spirit and philosophers who turn totally towards knowledge and towards God and devote their whole lives to understanding God and God's world and to loving God and becoming completely, completely enveloped in divine knowledge. These people are those who are present in the ruler's council. The ruler is God. This is the rank of the prophets. Among them there is he, he's referring to Moshe, who because of the greatness of his apprehensions means his intellectual knowledge of God, and is renouncing everything that's other than God, renouncing food, renouncing the physical world completely, has attained such a degree that is said of him, and he was there with the Lord. including questions, receiving answers, speaking and being spoken to in that holy place. Because of his great joy in that which he apprehended, he did neither eat bread nor drink water. For his intellect attained such strength that all the gross faculties in the body ceased to function. I mean the various kinds of the sense of touch. In other words, whereas we would, when we read the Bible, and we see about Moses 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai, didn't eat, didn't drink, we take it as, whatever we take it as, we think it's something supernatural, we think it's a metaphor. For the Rambam, it's something totally scientific. That Moshe, as it were, was able to divorce himself from his body. Remember, something we learned many years ago in this class, that for the Rambam, what is the afterlife? It's simply that the cardboard box, the soul, that's filled with divine knowledge, becomes so filled with God, who's eternal, that it becomes eternal, and it lives on, wait a second, lives on without the body. That is the afterlife. That is the disembodied soul. For the Rambam, Moshe Rabbeinu, his intellect, which is his mind, which is his soul, which is him, became so powerful and so connected to divine, to the God, that it lived on its own as if it didn't have a body, even while it's still alive. And therefore, didn't need any food and drink. For the Rambam, that is not something supernatural. That's totally within the realm of what the Rambam considers to be science. That the body was no longer necessary to nourish the mind. The mind existed on its own, and what helped it to exist, what gave it sustenance, the knowledge of God that was completely and absolutely in contact with. And when Moses came down with from the mountain, he still had his body there, which wasn't necessary, but when he left God, came down the mountain, so now his body came back to functioning to sustain the mind. But it's totally and absolutely a scientific process according to the Rambam. Harry?
Now, did the Torah actually say that Moses did not eat or drink?
Yes, it did.
He ascended the mountain.
Yes, it said that in Exodus chapter 34, verse 28.
I'll check. Alright.
34, 28. We're skipping to the next page. As we're skipping the end of 620, going to 621 at the bottom, the second paragraph. A call to attention. We have already made it clear to you that the intellect which overflowed from him, may he be exalted, towards us, is the bond between us and him. Right? We've heard that tens of times. You have the choice, says the Rambam to every reader. If you wish to strengthen and fortify this bond, you can do so. If, however, you wish to gradually make it weaker and feebler until it is cut off, you can also do so. You can only strengthen this bond by employing it in loving him. And according to the Rambam, love is a function of knowledge. In loving him and in progressing towards this, just as we have explained. And then it's made weaker and feebler if you busy your thought with what is other than him. If you stop thinking about God, stop thinking about divine science, if you think only about the corporal physical world, then you gradually weaken the bond between you and he. Know that even if you were the man who knew most the true reality of the divine science, you would cut that bond existing between you and God if you would empty your thought of God and busy yourself totally in eating the necessary or in occupying yourself with the necessary. You would not be with him then, nor he with you. For that relationship between you and him is actually broken off at that time. That's an important statement. Because here the Rambam says that the connection to God, which we know is the foundation of providence, the connection to God is not only a matter of having knowledge in your box, but it's rather a matter of at that moment reflecting on that knowledge and developing it. Right, so if you have your cardboard box filled with knowledge, right, and you filled with knowledge by connecting to the rays and the overflow of divine knowledge coming from God, so as long as you were gaining that knowledge and putting it into your box and meditating and reflecting on it, the connection to God existed. But the minute you stop meditating on it, even if the knowledge is in your box, the connection has been cut off at that moment.
So you have all this knowledge, and then you suddenly devote all of your time to feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and upholding the orphans and stuff, then you've cut yourself off from God.
That's what it looks like. That's what it looks like. Right? That's what it looks like.
Same question, except I was wondering, how does knowledge and this information that you're gathering from the overflow and your development of things that are progressive and helpful to mankind, how do you do that without cutting yourself off from God?
That's the next okay. Page. Very good.
Okay.
Very good.
It's always the page.
Last line of the page. It is for this reason that excellent men begrudge the times in which they are turned away from him by other occupations and warn against this, saying, "Do not let God be absent from your thought." And David says, "I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not bend down." He means to say, I do not empty my thought of him. The next line of the hand, next line and a half, I don't understand. And it is as if he were my right hand, from which, because of the rapidity of its motion, don't understand what that means, my attention is not distracted even for an instant, and therefore I do not bend down, that is, I do not fall. Now, I understand what it means, do not fall. In other words, if you're always setting your thought on God, you never fall. That's providence, of course. The Rambam then goes on to explain to us how to always keep your mind on God. We don't have to look at the practical, meditative instructions he gives us. We don't have time. And we go to page 623, in the middle paragraph. And there may be a human being, a human individual, who, through his apprehension of the true realities and his joy in what he apprehended, achieves a state, Joe, this is just what you asked, achieves a state in which he talks with people and is occupied with his bodily necessities while his intellect is wholly turned towards him, may he be exalted, so that in his heart he is always in his presence, may he be exalted, while outwardly he is with people. That is to say, there's the great Moshe Rabbeinu, who's able to work at the food bank and stuff boxes at the same time as really thinking of the philosophy of divine science. Rare individuals are able to do that. While outwardly he's with people, in the sort of way described by the poetic parables that have been invented for these notions. And now he quotes from the Song of Songs, "I sleep, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved that knocketh," and so on. In other words, you seem to be sleeping in the fact that you're out there at the food bank and you're out there eating and you're out there doing things in the physical world, which is sleeping from a real, true spiritual perspective, because those things are just sleep. Those things are not important. But inside your heart, which means your mind, is awake and you're with God, even though you're involved in all of these physical things. Now look what he says further. "I do not say that this rank is that of all the prophets." In other words, many prophets aren't able to do that. Many prophets prophesize they're with God, and then they stop and go have lunch, and it's this or that. And when they're having lunch, they're out to lunch. They're not with God. But he says, "But I do say that this is the rank of Moses our master, of whom it is said, and Moses alone shall come near unto the Lord, but they shall not come near. And of whom it is said, and he was there with the Lord. And of whom it is said, but as for thee, stand thou here with me." In other words, he means to say Moses was always with God, even when he seemed to be talking to his wife. He was only talking to his wife. He was multitasking. Right? He was able to hide the fact that he was really involved in something important at the moment he was talking to his wife. He was together with God. And by the way, it's not just his wife. Even if he was talking to me, that's unimportant. Right? According to the Rambam's understanding, it's all about the intellectual, which is the spiritual connection to God, which is about knowledge. All this, according to what we've explained regarding the meaning of these verses, this was also the rank of the patriarchs. The result of whose nearness to him, may he be exalted, was that his name became known to the world through them. the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, this is my name forever. Because of their union of their intellects through apprehension of him, they became united with God. It came about that he made a lasting covenant with them, that I'll remember my covenant with Jacob and so on. For in those four, I mean the patriarchs and Moses our master, union with God, I mean apprehension of him and love of him became manifest as the text testified. Also the providence of God watching over them and over their prosperity was great. So that word posterity, I have no idea. How could their connection with God through the intellectual union have anything to do with their posterity? I admit I don't understand.
What is posterity? The richness of his knowledge.
Their children. Say it again.
The richness of his knowledge would bring him prosperity.
No, posterity.
Posterity.
What is posterity?
Children.
Oh.
So I don't understand that at all. Unless it's one of the Rambam's efforts to fool us. And as we said, there are many efforts like that in the guide. And he says at the very beginning that that's his purpose, to fool us and throw us off track so we don't find his secret message.
But why wouldn't that be referring to the covenant with these folks?
He says the providence of God watching over them and over their posterity was great.
Well, didn't he make a deal, so to speak, with Abraham to make him a great nation?
Yeah, but how does it fit into the Rambam's philosophy that Abraham's intellectual apprehension of God, which could save him at that moment from making a mistake in the physical world, how could that affect his children?
Oh, okay.
That I don't understand. Unless it means, of course, that Abraham passed on to his children the fact that you have to be involved with God. The command to be involved with God. And that is the providence that watches over future generations.
But in this case, Abraham and the children are not the recipients. I mean, they're the recipients. God is watching over them.
Right.
But what you're talking about, their reaction toward God. But it's the other way around.
No, wait. Again, God doesn't do anything. God just overflows the knowledge. And we make the decision to tap into it or not tap into it.
Well, what does it mean, what God watching over them? What does that mean?
It means just that God has a static, unchanging flow of knowledge. And God has set up the world so that those who tap into it are rewarded and those who don't are punished. How are we rewarded? By knowledge of medicine, knowledge of physics, knowledge of economics, and we make our lives better as we've been talking. With all, they were occupied with governing people, increasing their fortune, and endeavoring to acquire property. Now this, to my mind, a proof. Hello, Mo. Let me give Mo the sources, but right over here.
Okay, thank you.
With all, they were occupied with governing people, increasing their fortune, and endeavoring to acquire property. Now this is, to my mind, a proof that they perform these actions with their limbs only, while their intellects were constantly in his presence, may he be exalted. It also seems to me that the fact that these four were in a permanent state of extreme perfection in the eyes of God, and that his providence watched over them continually, even when they were engaged in increasing their fortune, I mean, while they tended their cattle, did agricultural work, and governed their household, was necessarily brought about by the circumstance that in all these actions their end was to come near to him, may he be exalted, and how near. So what he seems to be saying is that although it's true that Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were involved in the physical world, it was a matter of multitasking. And they were really at the same time focused completely and absolutely on God. And that's how it could be that they were governed by constant divine providence. Which means, of course, that had they not been multitasking, had they really been 100% involved in buying sheep at any given moment, at that moment they would be disconnected from God and disconnected from providence, and they could have been hit by a bolt of lightning as a chance occurrence. But no, since they were constantly and always involved with God, therefore divine providence watched over them 100% of the time. Just wait a second. And it's not, of course, clear how that could be. Because a divine providence is, as we've explained for the past 7 weeks, according to the Rambam, and as we summarized half an hour ago, right? That providence is one of two things. It's either the practical knowledge that allows you to navigate the world and prevent self-inflicted injury, or it's the emotional attitude that makes you disconnected from the physical world and teaches you that all that is important is the spirit. Well then, according to that, it means the person with providence is able to overcome self-inflicted injuries,
transcend them,
but is not able to avoid injuries inflicted by others or by the nature of matter. But when those injuries come, he just ignores them.
There's a stalk.
They're not affecting him. The question is, those two types of providence that we just summarized, that we've learned about in the past, do they fit into what the Rambam is saying now? It doesn't look like it. Because he would have to admit that Avram could have been hit by a stray arrow. He would just ignore it. But how does he say that they were totally and absolutely under God's providence because they were always focused on God? It's not exactly clear how the Rambam's superstructure that he's set down until now.
He's supposed to have knowledge of Aristotle also, though, right? So philosophy
of course,
and
of course.
Science would make a person want to take care of themselves.
Of course. But so that only deals with self-inflicted injuries.
Yeah.
But how does he say that totally and absolutely there would be full providence over these unique individuals? Even if it's only four people in all the world, we still have to understand how it fits into the Rambam's theory. So Shmuel Ibn Tibon said, I don't understand. Give an example of one modern researcher, Julius Gutmann, who was one of the most famous historians of Jewish philosophy in the middle of the 20th century. He said, here the Rambam waxes mystical and the system breaks down. But that can't be. What's the system? The Rambam is not denying science. He's not denying everything he's founded upon. So what is actually going on here? Did someone want to, Chip, you wanted to say something else?
I'm going to withhold my question for later on.
Okay. Okay.
So he's saying a retarded person
has no providence, of course.
Has no providence. What about a blind and deaf person?
To a degree that they can study science and philosophy.
Okay. And he said also two times ago that the knowledge, whatever you want to call it, is ongoing. It's just that these four individuals are more perceptive.
Totally tapped into it.
Okay. So when David was having an affair with Bathsheba, how was that going on?
Well, David is not one of those four that the Rambam indicates. So when he was having an affair with Bathsheba, we can assume he had forgotten for those few moments about God.
Well, then let's take Jacob, who is mentioned.
Yes.
When he's stealing his brother's blessing, he's still in tune with God.
I guess so. And he's probably doing it because he understands that's the best way to accomplish what has to be accomplished, according to the Rambam, for his own good and for the good of the world.
How does the Rambam rationalize that God's static and unchanging when we're supposed to be getting our knowledge from God? Which means that our knowledge is not going to be static and unchanging once we acquire it.
God's knowledge is static and unchanging because he's broadcasting everything there is to be broadcast for all time and all eternity. He's broadcasting all knowledge at once. He has it all, and he'll make the same broadcast in the year zero that he'll make in the year 5 million. It's the same broadcast. It never changes.
I don't buy that.
You don't have to buy it. I doubt that there's anyone in this room that buys everything we're learning, but we're getting an insight, if we can, into the Rambam.
There's a stretch to it, you know.
I understand.
The Guide to the Perplexed was written for those individuals who could unravel, okay, the type of individuals we're talking. Moses could understand, for example, the Guide to the Perplexed.
Yes, that's what the Rambam would say.
Okay.
He hides from people who
on that level of knowledge.
All right. So the Guide to Perplexed is written for one in a thousand. Mm-hmm. And the Rambam says that openly.
Yeah, I guess this thing about taking your eyes off God, I sort of think, well, you know, with Jacob wrestling with the angel of death, when he took his, the commentary said when he took his eyes or thoughts off God, that's when he was wounded in the hip. I'm wondering if he's had thoughts of that when he was saying, you know, with the patriarchs, if they ever take their mind off God, things happen to them.
Yeah, but here the Rambam seems to say pretty clearly the patriarchs never took their mind off God.
See, that one commentary, you know, when he was, when Jacob was wrestling with the angel of death, he did. According to the commentary, Rashi.
Okay, according to Rashi. The Rambam is not bound to Rashi.
Maybe Rashi missed it.
Yes. Rashi was not a follower of the Rambam. Of course, I'm being anachronistic there. Rashi became before the Rambam, but he would not have been, we can assume, a follower of the Rambam.
Given Maimonides' views on this, would he be in favor of like a Jewish monasticism or hermitage or hermetic?
From what he writes in this chapter, it looks like the answer is yes, as we're about to see. The Rambam is a very, very complex thinker, right? That's why books and books and libraries of books have been written about the Rambam. We're just scratching scratching of the surface.
Well, of course, you pointed out that this is somebody's interpretation of what they admittedly didn't understand.
No, I'm reading the Rambam. This is the Rambam.
Well, this translation was coming. We're not reading it in Arabic. We're reading a translation which was done by somebody who admittedly didn't understand what was meant in the Arabic.
Actually, I didn't say that. This is a translation into English. It was the translation into Arabic by Shmuel ibn Tibon. He said he didn't understand.
Yes, right.
But our English translator, perhaps he understood. But I do want to emphasize that although what Bob said is true, we are learning a translation here, every book I've ever read admits that this is almost the perfect translation, one of the best translations of any ancient text into modern language. That's what they say. So,
you can translate something and not understand it. All you're doing is repeating the words.
Let's not get into that conundrum, okay? That's a debate.
Ultra-Orthodox don't really like Maimonides. Is that generally true or is that wrong?
That's generally true and also wrong.
Okay.
I'll explain that. I think we mentioned this a little bit last week. Let me tell you a joke. This joke used to go around the Department of Jewish Philosophy when I was doing my master's degree many, many decades ago. There are many philosophers who've tried to understand the Rambam. Thousands. In our day, there's David Hartman, and there was Rabbi Soloveitchik, and there was the translator, the author of the introductory essay, Leo Strauss. So they like to say that for everyone, there's a Soloveitchik Maimonides, and there's a Hartman Maimonides, there's a Strauss Maimonides, and there's my Maimonides. Right? Everyone has their own Maimonides because there's so much there. And there's so much richness, and there seems to be so much contradiction, and there are books of different genres. He wrote medicine, he wrote halakha, he wrote philosophy. He wrote a book on logic. So, the Rambam that I know, that I was taught, is not accepted in the yeshiva world. But a different Rambam is accepted.
When you say not accepted, the Mishnah Torah is accepted.
Exactly, the Mishnah Torah is, of course, the major work of Jewish law. It's accepted as a foundation of all of Jewish law in the yeshivot. The Guide to Perplexed is not learned. And many would claim, I take it back, a minority would claim that the Rambam didn't write this. It can't be. It must have been someone else. It's a forgery. But as far as we know, he wrote it, and therefore, as budding philosophers, we have an obligation to try to understand it.
But like in Israel, the Haredi people they don't do anything but study. I mean, that's sort of they're sort of like follow this philosophy, which you
About the heat.
In a certain sense, Greg Carolyn is right. There is a great emphasis on study. Now, of course, but you have to understand, remember, the things we're learning are a radical interpretation of Judaism. But they do have a foundation in Judaism. They're not totally and absolutely off the wall. Now, the rabbis have said for thousands of years that Talmud Torah keneged kulam, the study of Torah, is the most important mitzvah. The Rambam interpreted to mean that a certain type of study is the most important. But he's in consonance with the tradition that study is the most important thing. He's just interpreting in a certain fashion. The Haredi world is involved in study, a different type of study. But study, again, Talmud Torah keneged kulam. Talmud Torah is the most important mitzvah.
When we were talking about the patriarchs here and their constant connection with the overflow, where did it say constant? Where did it say all the time that there was no break?
No break in their reception.
Yes.
You're asking me to go back and look at all the words we've just read?
Well, no, we've read that into it, but only I'm wondering if, you know, we have some examples here where the patriarchs did things that we didn't think that were consistent, and well, I guess what I'm saying, is he saying that they cannot or never break this flow of information?
He's saying that what made them great? Well, is that they were few, they were among the few in the world that were able to never break that connection.
It did say never.
You know what? From now on, we'll see if he says never.
Okay, because I'm wondering if this isn't a situation with these are as close to perfection as possible, but not necessarily perfection.
Okay, I can read again the middle of 623. Which, you're right, doesn't say never, but I think implies it, where he said in the middle of 6:23, the paragraph beginning with, and there may be a human individual. The new paragraph in the middle of
6:23.
There's an even better one, Rabbi, on 6:24.
Yeah.
It also seems to me that the fact that these four were in permanent state of extreme perfection in the eyes of God.
Okay, that's good. Thank you.
Always watches.
Okay.
May I ask then again? The Torah does not explain a lot about Moses, just what in fact he did. So how one does he derive this? And then get to the problem of the burning bush, where he must have been out of sync because he wasn't allowed to go into Eretz Yisrael. Is that
the? It's true. The Torah doesn't say that Moses was an Aristotelian philosopher.
No, I understand that.
But the Rambam says he was.
Okay.
Right?
All right, so it is a thing. So how does he explain the burning bush?
Wait a second. The Rambam says that scientifically, rationally, there's no way that Moses could have gotten the Torah, except if he was an Aristotelian philosopher. Because by definition, what is Torah? Torah is knowledge. How does knowledge come to human being? Only through the human being developing his ability to receive the broadcast. So the Rambam reads the Torah. The Rambam reads all of Jewish tradition in light of science. Because science is true. And Torah is true. And therefore, there cannot be a contradiction between them. And since science is clear, and the Torah is sometimes unclear, therefore I will read the Torah, I will interpret the Torah in light of truth, in light of science. And therefore I'll come to the true, deeper meaning of the Torah. The Rambam says explicitly, that's the way to learn Torah. And by the way, I'll just say at this point, that is perhaps one of the enduring messages of the Rambam for the modern man. It's not that the Rambam's particular solutions to particular issues are always going to be meaningful to modern man. many in this room feel that the Rambam solutions are not meaningful, but his methodology and his assumptions are what's so meaningful to modern man. To read Judaism, to read Torah, without putting your mind on hold, without putting your scientific knowledge on hold. That everything that's true has to be consistent with everything else that's true. The Rambam assumes that science is true. The Rambam assumes that Torah is true. Now, of course, we have a problem in our day. Not just that the Rambam solutions don't often help us, but rather the Rambam science no longer is considered in our day to be science. Science has changed. But if we want to take the Rambam's guidance, then we can learn from his principles that you should read religion in light of the best science of the day, the best philosophy of the day, the best truth of the day, and then go from there. But always search for that synthesis. That's his enduring, among his enduring messages to modern man. Okay, back to Providence. We're on page 624. About six lines from the top. Now this is, to my mind, a proof that they performed these actions with their limbs only, while their intellects were constantly in his presence, may he be exalted. It also seems to me that the fact that these four, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Moshe, were in a permanent state of extreme perfection in the eyes of God, and that his providence watched over them continually even while they were engaged in creating their fortune, I mean while they tended their cattle, did agricultural work, and governed their households, was necessarily brought about by the circumstances that in all these actions their end was to come near to him may be exalted, and how near, etc. Now, I'd like to point out, it doesn't say that God's providence helped them to amass their fortune. It says the opposite. The fact that they were amassing their fortune, which should have interrupted providence, didn't. Because despite the fact that they were involved in the physical world in amassing fortune, their eyes and their ears and their whole body and really their mind was on God at all that time. So the physical world, in their case, didn't get in the way of providence. Whereas in our case, us in the room, the physical world does get in the way of providence. When we engage in eating, there's no providence. Because we're not connected to the divine overflow at that moment. But they were able to be connected to the overflow even while they were tending their cattle.
What if you say the brachot and you have a devoir Torah during the meal?
Very good. Very good.
You're doing your best you can.
Right. So if I say the brachot and I use them in the proper fashion, not just as empty words, right? And if I don't even have 5 minutes without some type of connection to God, then I'm like, at that moment, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and Moshe.
Okay, we have this overflow, and we have our receivers tuned to accept it. And as long as we're accepting it, we are connected to God. And with this constant connection means, metaphorically, we're listening to our receiver. We're gaining knowledge. Does that mean the question is, does the application of that knowledge, is that part of providence, or is that interfering with my gaining more knowledge?
I was waiting for that question.
Oh, well, I had a note here I was supposed to ask you.
That's exactly what's not clear. That's exactly what's not clear here.
They have to be independent.
Let me say what Joe said in different language.
Yes, in Hebrew.
That's quite interesting.
The question basically is, what is the mechanism of this providence? How does it work? If it's not God supernaturally intervening and protecting me in a bubble, which it's not, because this is the Rambam, if it's something else, if it's something somehow naturalistic, which it has to be, well, what is it? How is it that this knowledge, this constant knowledge, how is it? What's the mechanism that it protected the patriarchs and Moshe? What is it? That's what's not clear. And I'm setting it up to present two options. But it's not clear.
But each of these great men shared their knowledge. They didn't just obtain it. They also shared it. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the deal. You know, I mean, a scientist that sits in a lab and figures out how to cure cancer and then doesn't tell anybody about it, that's a total waste.
What you're saying, I'll simply say, is not clear if you're right or not. Because we're about to see that the Rambam seems to disagree with you. He seems to say that the more solitude, the better. Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov were able to engage in conversation with people while they were with God, but most of us can't. And therefore, solitude is better, it seems, as we're about to read.
Yeah, well, we really get stuck, I think, in the question of what is meant by the intellect being constantly in the presence. It's not just saying the bracha, because while you're eating and you're munching on your corned beef sandwich, you're supposed to, according to this, somehow or another, God, you're in God's presence. It's not just sitting down and reading a piece of Gemara while you're munching on your sandwich. There's that whole idea is difficult to wrap
mind. Whatever it is, it's a total concentration on spirituality. Let me just tell everyone a story. It was about the year 1979, and while I was in yeshiva, I also was devoting time to doing a bachelor's degree, and I was doing it basically by correspondence, a bachelor's degree in Jewish studies while I was in yeshiva, and I was allowed to do an independent study of the Rambam. And during the month vacation between Rosh Hashanah and after Sukkot, I spent the whole month, every day, every hour, learning the Guide to the Perplexed. And I focused on Providence for a whole month. And I just remember the sense of total and absolute devotion to God that I experienced, or thought that I experienced, while I was learning the Guide to Perplexed for a whole month. And at least at that point, I thought that I had, to a certain degree, tapped into that total and absolute devotion, knowledge, intellectualization, / meditation that the Rambam is talking about.
This isn't a question of devotion.
So
devotion is not part of it.
No, it's part of it. It's meditation, devotion, intellectualization, rationality.
But it's the intellectual aspect of it.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
It's the intellect.
But it's an intellect that's totally devoted, and it's an intellect that breeds love of God. So devoted to the source of knowledge.
Of course, I wasn't here for the other classes, so I don't know whether this guide was to make you less perplexed or more perplexed. but I'm wondering, what's the purpose? Maybe we're going to come to this. You singled out four people out of millions and millions of Jews. Only four reached this status. And it's been 3,000 years since anybody has gotten there. So what's the... I mean, I'm not sure what the...
Okay, so you'll see in a moment. You'll see in a moment. You'll see something very important in a moment. We're going on to the bottom of 624, where the bracket is, 7 or 8 lines from the bottom, new paragraph. A most extraordinary speculation has occurred to me just now, through which doubts may be dispelled and divine secrets revealed. You guys ready? We have already explained in the chapters concerning providence that providence watches over everyone endowed with intellect proportionally to the measure of his intellect. Thus, providence always watches over an individual endowed with perfect apprehension, whose intellect never ceases from being occupied with God. On the other hand, an individual endowed with perfect apprehension, whose thought sometimes for a certain time is empty of God, is watched over by providence only during the time when he thinks of God. Providence withdraws from him during the time when he's occupied with something else. That's important, what we just read. We'll come back and explain it. However, its withdrawal, then, is not like its withdrawal from those who have never had intellectual cognition to begin with. But in his case, that providence merely decreases because that man of perfect apprehension has, while being occupied with something else, no intellect in actu, in actuality. But that perfect man is at such times only apprehending potentially, though close to actuality. At such times, he's like a skillful scribe at the time when he is not writing. But you have intellect and you have knowledge, but not at that moment actualizing it. On the other hand, he who has no intellectual cognition at all of God is like one who is in darkness and has never seen light. Just so we have explained with regard to the dictum, the wicked shall be put to silence and darkness. He who apprehends and advances with his whole being toward the object of his apprehension is like one who is in the pure light of the sun. He who has had apprehension but is occupied with something else is, while he is occupied in the state, like one who has a cloudy day in which the sun does not shine because of the clouds that separate it and him. Hence it seems to me that all prophets or excellent and perfect men whom one of the evils of this world befell, had this evil happened to him during such a time of distraction, the greatness of the calamity being proportionate to the duration of the period of distraction or to the vileness of the matter with which he was occupied. If this is so, the great doubt that induced the philosophers to deny that divine providence watches over all human individuals and to assert equality between them and the individuals of the other kinds of animals is dispelled. He just solved the problem of theodicy. That's what's so important here. He just solved the problem of theodicy. What did he just say? Look, he said it's simple. If providence is a function of receiving of the overflow, and receiving of the overflow is a function of concentration and meditation on the overflow at that moment.
A mindfulness of it.
Yeah. Mindfulness. And whenever that mindfulness is lost because you're eating or drinking or doing anything else, at that moment there's no connection to the overflow. At that moment there's no providence. That solves the problem of theodicy. Because any time someone gets hit by a bus, I'll say it was because at that moment he was eating lunch and he wasn't concentrating on God.
But maybe he was concentrating on God and wasn't aware of a bus coming. He was so much concentrating.
We'll get to that in a second, actually, Chip.
So back
to the question of what actually, how does this work? What's the mechanism? But at least in theory, the Rambam says at this moment, Eureka, I've solved the problem of theodicy. And it doesn't bother the Rambam anymore that for 95% of people, they're getting hit by buses and dying of cancer. Because those are people that either weren't ever mindful of God, or they were, but not at the moment that they got hit. That's the answer to, that's the Odyssey. The Rambam solved the problem.
So this means that someone who's devoting himself 100% in a yeshiva, and some suicide bomber comes in and blows the place up.
It couldn't happen.
Must have lost his concentration.
Must have, right. But of course, you're assuming that in yeshiva they learn about God. They might not, but that's a different can of worms.
Right?
So, and therefore, the Rambam says, there's only four people in the world that were they to get hurt, it would impinge upon my theory of theodicy. And those are the four people that never lost their concentration. Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Moshe. But if anyone else gets hurt, it's not a problem, because I understand now that at that moment, they weren't connected to God. And that's why the accidents of the earth afflicted them.
So Moses' stuttering was...
Don't ask me little questions.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You understand that Rambam could find a solution, right?
I know.
He'll give an answer.
Yeah. Some people have interpreted that stuttering as that Moses didn't speak Hebrew growing up in an Egyptian household. And that's why he needed Aaron, someone else, to speak, because he couldn't speak to the Jewish people.
And that might have been for the good.
Midrash with the call was better.
Say it again?
He could sing in Hebrew.
Okay, so we're going to read on. We're in the middle of page 625. I'll begin again from the sentence, if this is so. If this is so, the great doubt that induced the philosophers to deny that divine providence watches over all human individuals and to assert equality. The philosophers assert equality between them and the individual other kinds of animals. In other words, Aristotle said, for example, Epicurus said that the accidents that happen to monkeys happen to human beings. There's no providence. Says the Rambam, you're wrong. It's just that at that moment that the human being got hit by the bus, at that moment he was a monkey, because he wasn't involved in developing his human intellect. For their proof, the proof of the philosophers, for this opinion that there's no providence, was the fact that excellent and good men experience great misfortunes. Thus the secret with regard to this has been explained even according to the requirements of their opinions. The providence of God, may be exalted, is constantly watching over those who have obtained this overflow, which is permitted to everyone who makes effort with a view to obtaining it. If a man's thought is free from distraction, if he apprehends, it may be exalted in the right way, and rejoices when he apprehends, that individual can never be afflicted with evil of any kind, for he is with God and God is with him. When, however, he abandons him, may be exalted, and is thus separated from God, and God is separated from him, he becomes in consequence of this a target for every evil that may happen to befall him. Accidents happen. For the thing that necessarily brings about providence and delivery from the sea of chance consists in that intellectual overflow. Yet an impediment may prevent for some time it's reaching the excellent good man in question, because he got distracted. Or again, it was not obtained at all by such and such imperfect and wicked men, and therefore the chance occurrences that befell them happened. Right? If you never study, then the world afflicts you. To my mind, this belief is also shown as true by a text of the Torah. He may be exalted, says, and I'll hide my face from them. Right? This is a quote from Deuteronomy. I'll hide my face from them, and they shall be devoured, and many evils and troubles shall come upon them, so that they will say in that day, are not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us? It is clear that we are the cause of this hiding of the face, right? God doesn't hide his face. The intellect is always flowing. The divine overflow is always there. But rather, what does it mean God hides his face? It means we hide our face from his face. So it's if he's hiding his face. But the intellect is always there. It is clear that we are the cause of this hiding of the face, and we're the agents who produce this separation. This is the meaning of his saying, and I will surely hide my face in that day for all the evil which they have wrought. Now, we read it usually and think, the Jews sinned, they didn't keep Shabbat, they didn't eat kosher, so God punishes them. No, says the Rambam. The evil that the Jews perpetrated was ignorance. As we've learned already, that Yetzirah and ignorance are the same thing. The evil they perpetrated was not being involved in God, not thinking about God. The minute they're distracted, whether it was for 5 minutes or 5 days or 5 years, then it's just God's hiding his face, and all the terrible kalot, all the curses listed at the end of Deuteronomy and other places in the Torah will come upon them. Not because God brought those evils, just because they happened accidentally.
They're random.
They're random. But if you're not protected by God's overflow, then those random things will eventually get you. There is no doubt that what is true of one is true of a community. In other words, it's both on the individual level and the communal level. The verse is talking about the community, but it's also true, says the Rambam, for the individual. Thus, it has become clear to you that the reason for a human individual's being abandoned to chance, so that he is permitted to be devoured like the beasts, is his being separated from God. If, however, his God is within him, then that's knowledge in your cardboard box, always flowing in, no evil at all will befall him. For he, may he be exalted, says, fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God, and so on. That's a verse from Isaiah. He says, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee, and through the rivers they shall not overflow thee, and so on, from Isaiah. The determination that when thou passest through the waters, and I will be with thee, the rivers shall not overflow thee, is accounted for by the fact that everyone who has rendered himself so worthy that the intellect in question overflows toward him, this person has providence attached him, while all evils are prevented from befalling him. It says, the Lord is for me, I will not fear. What can man do unto me? And it says, acquaint now thyself with him and be at peace. Meaning to say, turn toward him and you will be safe from all ill. We only have a few more. That's it. We only have one more page.
And then we'll have a perfect understanding of my mouth.
Right. Consider the song on mishaps, one of the psalms. You will find that it describes this great providence and the safeguard and the protection from all bodily ills, both the general ones and those that concern one individual rather than another, so that neither those that are consequent upon the nature of being nor those that are due to the plotting of men would occur. Look what the Rambam just did. He's referring now to his list of the three sources of evil. Remember, the first one is evil that's a result of the nature of matter, that there's passing away, there's metabolism passing away and coming to being. And the second is things people do to others, and the third is what people do to themselves. Now, the third category, what people do to themselves, we already solved that in earlier chapters. We said that evil that people do to themselves, when you have the divine broadcast, a practical knowledge, you learn how to be responsible and not harm yourself. And that's 95% or 90% of the evils that happen to people, that's providence. And the other 10% of things that happen, either from others or from the nature of matter, that has been solved earlier, we had said, by the Stoic immunity from being affected by those things. But now the Rambam says, look what he just said. He's the fourth line of the paragraph in the middle. Upon the nature of being, consequent upon the nature of being, nor those that are due to the plotting of men. That's categories 1 and 2. See what I'm saying? Consequent upon the nature of being, that's category 1. Nor those that are due to the plotting of men, that's category 2. He now says those two categories, it's not merely, so it seems he's saying, that you're stoically immune from their effect. He says they won't happen. How could that be? Again, we're back to the question, what are you talking about? The whole chapter, we don't yet understand yet the mechanism of this seeming supernatural providence. It says that he will deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with his pinions, and under his wings thou shalt take refuge. His truth is a shield and a buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flieth by day, of the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor of the destruction that wasteth at noon. He then goes on to describe the protection against the plotting of men. Right, that was the things that happened because of the nature of matter. Pestilence. If you should happen to pass on your way a widely extended field of battle, and even if 1,000 were killed to your left and 10,000 to your right, no evil at all would befall you. Do you not perceive and see with your eye God's judgment and retribution directed against the wicked that are killed while you are safe? These are its words in the Psalms. 1,000 may fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand. It shall not come nigh thee. Only with thine eyes shalt thou behold and see the recompense of the wicked. This is followed by what is said about divine safeguard. Then it gives the reason for this great protection, saying that the reason for this great providence being effective with regard to the individual in question is this: because he hath set his passionate love upon me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him on high because he hath known my name. We've already explained in preceding chapters that the meaning of knowledge of the name is apprehension of him. It is as if the psalm said that this individual is protected because he hath known me and then passionately loved me. You know the difference between the terms of one who loves and one who is passionately in love. An excess of love, so that no thought remains that is directed toward anything but that the beloved. That's passionate love. Passionate love of God is the highest level of knowledge of God. So, that's all we have to read. We're finished. But what did we see?
It makes no sense.
It seems to make no sense. That's what Shmuel Ibn Tibon said. So first, let's understand the great insight we did gain here in the negative sense. The Rambam explained to us theodicy. He explained why bad things happen to good people. It's because those people were either not connected to God or not connected at that moment. And for the Rambam, that's a tour de force, right? He's explained everything that greatly bothered the philosophers that dealt with theodicy for thousands of years. Great.
To his satisfaction.
To his satisfaction. But that's on the negative. But on the positive, what did he say? He waxed mystical. He waxed beautiful.
If you connected, if you're mindful of God always, nothing terrible will happen to you.
That's what he said. Yeah. But how could that be? How could it be scientifically?
You're so focused on God that nothing else will matter. You're so focused on God.
Nothing else will matter? What does that mean? What does it mean? What do you mean, nothing else will matter?
Nothing else that occurs to you in your life around you will matter, or to yourself. If you're 100% tuned into God and devoted to Him and being faithful to Him, you'll transcend everything else.
You will what? You will
transcend everything.
Transcend. Else. What does transcend mean?
Yeah, but that assumes that you're doing it at a certain level. Most people can't do.
This is only about Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Moshe, right?
Yeah.
Robert, were you about to say something, or?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You can't. Unfortunately, you can't do this.
Can't explain what we just read.
No, you can't have this devotion all the time.
Or you can't reach the level.
I mean, you have a body that cries out for hunger and thirst, and the great majority of your thinking occurs at an unconscious level, not to your conscious mind. And you have sexual passions, and you feel cold and heat. And so, unfortunately, you can't be devoted to and connected with God all the time. And so, the bad things will happen to you.
The Rambam says a number of places that one of the beautiful effects of getting older is overcoming passion. And the Rambam certainly either experienced on his own or envisioned experiencing a life without passion, with no desire to eat or to drink or sexuality or affluence, nothing. Just love of God. Jay.
This concept does not take into account any formulation of justice, in the sense, just to using the same frame of reference, that here is a person who is striving all of his or her life in order to maintain the reception to God, thinking about it, filling the box, and contemplating about what's in the box, can do this for 99.9% of that person's entire existence, which is impossible, as Bob said. That's really not really possible. But let's assume, hypothetically. And for 0.1% of the time that it were to waver, then that person might be stricken by something that is, you would say, that providentially, that shouldn't happen to such a person, because that is a good person. So the answer to the question has not been answered. That why do bad things happen to good people? You can say that person wavered for a second, but what about all of the other time? Now, maybe you would answer that that person during that time that he was doing all this was spared, and therefore this is providential. Secondly, I think that Rambam's own life, I mean Maimonides' own life, is a contradiction to that. Exactly. Because he was a physician. He helped the sick. Instead of trying to cure illness, he should be teaching them how to get closer to God, which he wasn't doing, evidently, as a physician.
Well, he was also doing. He found time to write.
I got this.
No, but I'm saying in the practical sense of how you might apply such a philosophy, instead of trying to cure the person who looks like providence has been against them, the cure is not curing their disease. they will just only have another disease tomorrow.
But if they attain perfect knowledge of God,
but what they would,
it'll
what
be
what he should
the patient
be doing
will be oblivious.
Is teaching them how to get closer to God, and that's not what he was doing.
No, he was also doing that. No, he was certainly doing that in all his writings. He's doing that. He was doing both. And he, by the way, does write in some places that his whole profession of medicine was not of his own desire. It's only because his brother died in a shipwreck, and therefore he had to work for a living.
Yep.
But it was not part of his plan.
But writing what he's doing only could appeal to those that had the intellect to accept it. The people that he was treating did not have such an intellect. He could have helped them better, hypothetically, according to his own philosophy, by teaching them specifically, one-on-one, instead of trying to cure their illness. He could have been trying to improve their intellect, which, according to his philosophy, would help them a lot more than curing their disease. And lastly,
he could have been.
Lastly, one last point, and that is, this does not explain what were providence, because sometimes only good things happen to bad people who don't do anything what you're talking about, who don't think about God, though they could, don't do any of these things, and live a perfectly long life, luxury, and all of these other things without any catastrophes happening to them. So it doesn't seem to apply universally.
I just want to say that Jay spoke very well.
Okay.
Right? There are little things I could say to answer, but basically your points are well taken.
But what if you take it in historical context? He wrote the Mishnah and Torah. He then writes and takes care of people. And then he has a few disciples that do not understand the Torah. And this is his intellectual response to them. I think that
you're right.
Take this in because the Mishnah Torah is accepted, but a lot of his interpretations, as I understand it, are not accepted universally. I mean, so
Yeah. Let me just add in response a little bit to Aaron, a little bit to Jay, that the Rambam's treating of the Sultan and his harem. For the Rambam was on the level of veterinary medicine. He was making a living.
I have another thought on that. I think that Rambam was an intellectual snob. He was an intellectual snob.
The nice way to say that is elitist.
Okay. I don't think that he felt that the average person was worth to teach.
Oh, I disagree with you, because you have two examples. One is the Mishnah Torah. Why did he write it? Why not leave it as complex as it was?
Yeah.
And the second is, if you look at some of his writings, they were responses to the Yemenites primarily, I don't know who else, who had certain practical problems about what to do with the Islam trying to convert them and all this kind of stuff. So I do think there was a humanistic...
Yeah. The Rambam did have, the philosopher has a responsibility to society. We didn't talk about it, it's not part of our subject here.
But he very clearly tells you in this document what he thinks of people.
I understand.
Don't study.
I understand.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
And I think the average person who came to him as a physician was probably in that category.
That's also true.
So
it's
why would he take his valuable time to try and teach them how to connect with God when he thought of them as dogs and cats?
But just let me answer it a little bit, and then I want to really talk about what I want to do in the last 10 minutes. The difference between the Sultan's harem and dogs and cats is the following. Dogs and cats will always remain dogs and cats. The Sultan's harem are dogs and cats that can become human beings. And there, I believe we talked about this last week, that you can train dogs and cats who are potential human beings to become human beings. And that might be one of the reasons he wrote the Mishnah Torah, and especially wrote the 13 principles of faith, which we said last week are the basic philosophical principles that allow you to have a modicum of knowledge of God to become a human being. So let's finish by trying to figure out what it might be the Rambam saying in this last chapter. So let's go to the sheet that I prepared.
Well, I don't have a copy of that sheet.
Now you do. And at the very bottom, I wrote, this is at the bottom, three levels of providence, the third bullet point. The highest level of providence, which is available only to Moshe, the patriarchs, and those select few on their level. This is ambiguous, right, to say the least. And then I write, and maybe either an extension of level one or an extension of level two. I'm going to try and explain everything we learned today in chapter 51. Either as an extension of the providence that the Rambam discussed in what I call level one, or the providence he discussed in level two. Level one providence was the practical knowledge that you get through your receiver that allows you to responsibly navigate the hazards of this world. That is to say, the self-inflicted evils and mishaps that you could avoid if you knew better. And the providently watched person is the one connected enough to the divine knowledge that he's able to navigate the world so as to avoid those mishaps. That's level number one. Level number two is the Rambam's commentary on Job. That is to say, the way to rise above even evils inflicted by others upon you or by the nature of matter is to stoically become immune to things that affect you on the physical level. So what is the Rambam doing in chapter 51? As far as I understand in the commentators, the way to understand it is either not to understand it, or to say it's either an extension of type 1 of providence or an extension of type 2. What do I mean, extension of type 1? This is the approach of Moshe ibn Tibbon, the son of Shmuel ibn Tibbon, who is the translator of the guide into Hebrew. And he said that we're talking about such a full, complete, intuitive, and prophetic knowledge of God that you're able to avoid, literally avoid, navigate around all of the evils of the world, not just those things inflicted upon you by yourself, but also inflicted by others and inflicted by the nature of matter. In other words, on the battlefield, you would know how to avoid the sword and the gun and the trap. And you'd know how to avoid all diseases, even those that are a consequence of the nature of matter. Even genetic diseases and even cancer, whatever it might be, this highest level of knowledge that, again, is only garnered by Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Moshe, is simply continuation and a refinement of the first type of providence, so you can avoid everything through knowledge. And by the way, if you understand like that, it's an unbelievably inspirational guidepost to the advancement of human knowledge, to the point at which, on a medical, economic, political, social, cultural level, we will perfect society. Someday, to that level, will there be no evil of any sort?
And there'll be no society.
That's another question. It's a good point.
Yeah.
That might be the days of the Messiah, according to the Rambam. That's what Moshe ibn Tibbon says. Is it completely satisfactory? No. Is it realistic? Doesn't seem to be. The approach of Charles Rappel, in the article he wrote many years ago, when was this written? In 1987. Not that many years ago, but a number, three decades almost. He says, no, the providence discussed, the providence of Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov and Moshe in chapter 51 is not an extension of level 1, it's an extension of level 2. Level 2 is the Rambam on Job. And what he says, and this is perhaps a little bit more convincing, he says that Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov and Moshe were able to define themselves out of their bodies. Moshe on Mount Sinai, didn't eat and didn't drink, was basically Moses after his death, but while he was living. He became a disembodied intellect, therefore he didn't eat and didn't drink, but rather was nourished by the divine knowledge, just like the soul after death is nourished by divine knowledge without the body. And therefore, Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and Moshe in life, they become completely disjointed from and disconnected from their bodies. There's only a little thread connecting to the body. They're almost as if dead already, but still living on this earth. And their intellects are alive without need of sustenance from the body. And if the body gets sick, they can completely ignore it, because it's not, the body is not necessary for the soul. If the body gets hit by an arrow, it doesn't affect their life, because their life is just in the soul and the intellect. And therefore, chapter 51 is an extension of the Job type of providence. In the Job type of providence, I live in my body, but I'm able to ignore and stoically refine myself above the pains of my body and the pain, the intellectual, the emotional pain of the death of my children. And now it's the same thing in chapter 51, but on a higher level. That it's not that I can ignore the pain of the body, but I really don't feel it, because it's not my body anymore. You're it's just there, but it's not really mine.
You're oblivious to it.
It's a, but I'm even more than oblivious.
It doesn't exist.
It really doesn't exist for my soul. It's as if I'm already dead. And just like after death, the one who had filled his cardboard box in life remains eternally alive, and the things that affect the body don't affect it after death. There's no longer any body. So in the same sense, even in life, for Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, and Moshe, the body is alive, but the soul is not dependent upon it. And therefore, all the things that happen to human beings don't impinge upon it. That's Charles Rappel's understanding of chapter 51 of the Guide. Leaves you speechless, I see. And I summarized all that on the sheets that I gave out at the very bottom. And by the way, I also summarized it in my own Guide to the Perplexed, which came out in the photostat on the second to last page, in case you want to see it.
Thank you, Rabbi.
So, I hope you find this exciting and invigorating.
Yes.
In another 2 weeks, we'll begin the Ralbag in the Wars of the Lord, Rabbi Levi Ben Gershom, in the Wars of the Lord, Milchamot Hashem, and he's certainly a follower of the Rambam. And we'll see very similar material, and we'll probably do that for, I don't know, how many weeks. Before that, that is to say, next week is our Purim festivities. We said everyone should arrive in costume with the Book of Esther at 10 o'clock, and Carol Ann has taken upon herself graciously to bring some food, and I'll arrive at about 10:30. Okay.
Well, we will occupy ourselves very constructively until you get here.
Thank you.
We'll be checking.